Now, while the government tries to figure out how far to go to curb pollution, one company in Southern California thinks it found the answer. 22,000 miles straight up. NPR's Ina Jaffe explains.
We all know how a conventional power plant works, right? You burn coal or natural gas or split some atoms that heats water, which makes steam, which sets a turbine spinning. And that makes electricity. But the Solarin company wants to make electricity that'd be associated with another kind of sound.
3, 2, 1. We have ignition and liftoff of a Delta.
Solarin, as you may guess from their name, is in the solar power business. And if you're looking for a location for a solar power plant, space has a lot going for it. There's sunshine 24/7, and the real estate is free. But getting all the parts up there and putting them all together, that's the hard part. Scientists have been looking for a way to do that for decades.
The thing in space was going to be so heavy, it was going to take, I mean, hundreds or thousands of rockets to put it in orbit and thousands of astronauts.
That's Gary Spurnak, the CEO of Solarin. About 8 years ago, he got together with a bunch of engineers he knew from his years at Hughes Aerospace.
You know, they'd been in the business for 20, 30 years. They had solved just impossible problems for, you know, working on a lot of government programs that you can't talk about.
So they all started trying to figure out how to make an orbiting solar power plant light enough so that it could be launched relatively cheaply. The solution they came up with was to not make one big thing, but to put two or three or even four separate modules in the same geosynchronous neighborhood.
They have a radar and they kind of track each other, and there's little thrusters that keep themselves into position.
So one part is, in essence, a big mirror that collects and focuses sunlight on part two, the solar panels, which beam energy to part three, a really huge antenna that focuses and beams power back to Earth in the form of radio waves.
Each of those parts could fit on an existing rocket, so you don't need to design a brand new rocket to go off and do things, and so that's great. Number two, since you don't have to put them together, you don't need astronauts or robots.
And in terms of technology, there's not a lot that's really new, says Spurnak. Satellites already run on solar power, and if you have satellite TV, you're already receiving radio waves from space. That's why Solarin believes it can have its solar power plant launched and operating in the year 2016.
If it works, it could be a real game changer in the industry and indeed for the entire world.
Says Jonathan Marshall, a spokesman for Pacific Gas and Electric. PG&E has signed the nation's first commercial contract to buy enough power from Solarin for nearly 250,000 homes. The price they agreed to is proprietary, but described by both parties as similar to ground-based solar. And there's no risk in this deal for PG&E, says Marshall.
We're paying only for the energy if and when it's delivered. If they don't deliver, we don't pay.
But even if Solarin can successfully deliver power, it may not be able to deliver for its investors, says Severin Borenstein, co-director of the Energy Institute at the UC Berkeley School of Business.
It seems pretty clear that technologically one can put solar panels in space and beam the power back to Earth. The question is whether Solarin can do it cost-effectively.
But by the year 2020, all California utilities will be required to produce a third of their power with renewable sources of energy. That's about double what they have right now. Ina Jaffe, NPR News.
In 1 month in 2007, Americans sent just under 50 billion text messages. Just a year later, in 2008, they sent more than twice that many, 110 billion. That's according to numbers compiled by a trade group, the Wireless Association. And this year, the number of text messages continues to skyrocket. One person who's been following this is Amanda Lenhart. She's a researcher with the Pew Research Center's Internet and American Life Project and joined us to talk about it. Good morning.
Good morning.
So let me guess, here in the United States, is it teenagers driving all that text traffic?
It is teenagers driving the traffic. Teenagers send an enormous number of text messages on a daily basis, let alone a monthly or yearly basis.
So including everyone who's using text messages, is it in a sense a new way for people to communicate? And I'm wondering what the charm is.
Well, I think there's a lot of different reasons why people and teens in particular like text messaging, partly because it's private. It's this opportunity to send a message where you won't be overheard. But teens also told us in some focus groups that we've conducted that they really love the efficiency of text messaging. I don't have to get on the phone. I don't have to have all these niceties and these talk about the weather. I just have to tell you, come and pick me up in front of the gym at 5 p.m. So they really like that efficiency of the text message, as well as the fact that you don't have to reach the person to get the information to them. It's not like a phone call where the person has to be on the other end.
Well, does that mean, if you reverse it, that all this texting is at the expense of making phone calls?
Well, you know, I think what we've seen is that, at least with teens, phone calling is still quite important. But text messaging does appear to be a more favored mode of communication for the majority of adolescents. With adults, what the Census Bureau findings, and I believe it's the Wireless Association's data, suggest that they're still making phone calls, but those phone calls might be a little bit shorter.
You know, there's an article on this in the LA Times, and a professor of communication studies was cited, and he said that all this texting could lead to, as he put it, a withering of interpersonal skills. Do you think that's a legitimate concern?
I think it's important to contextualize texting in the sort of vast range of communication that we've engaged in over time. So, you know, we used to send letters, and then we sent emails, and now we send text messages. In between all those communications, we're still talking with each other face-to-face. We're still talking on the telephone. I think we've had a long and rich history of text-based communication. I'm not too worried that it's going to be withering our abilities to communicate.
Well, when you say a long history of using text to communicate, the difference, though, is with text messaging is that it's very, very short. That could be considered a skill. I mean, there's a lot of witty Twitters out there, but doesn't seem quite in line with, you know, writing long letters to people.
That is very true. One thing that is important to note, though, is that the majority of adolescents, at least, have an unlimited text messaging plan. Even though you have this character limit, you can write a series of messages that conveys what you want. That said, it certainly is limiting, and that does change, I think, the way they talk and present themselves. But the English language is a fluid thing. We're changing it, and perhaps this will change English, but we'll continue speaking and interacting.
Thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
Amanda Lenhard is a senior research specialist at the Pew Research Center's Internet and American Life Project.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. At a time when unemployment sits at 10%, many laid-off workers are looking to reinvent themselves. Yesterday, NPR's Frank Langfitt introduced us to former furniture workers in North Carolina. After they lost their jobs, they returned to school to retrain by studying information technology.
The hope is to land work at a new Google data center, as one of them, Bill Curtis, explained.
Most of us right now are going to try to get a job with Google, which I think right now, from what I've been able to find out, is one of the better companies in the country to work for.
Frank Langfitt followed Curtis and other workers in North Carolina for more than 2 years. Today he reveals who got a job at Google and who didn't.
Bill Curtis lives down a dirt road in Lenoir, North Carolina. At age 53, he just finished a technology program at the community college. It was designed in part to help laid-off furniture workers like him apply to Google. I caught up with Curtis at the end of 2007, just before his final job interview. He rummaged through his closet, hunting for the right jacket.
Let me look back here in the archives.
What do you think your chances are of getting a job at Google?
I think my chances are pretty good. I'm not a shoo-in, but doggone, I don't know what else I can do to get ready. And we're going to make good associates for Google if we're hired. And I think they're going to be amazed to see what some ex-furniture workers can do when we're given the opportunity.
The interviews with Google managers stretched for several hours. Curtis stumbled over some software questions. At the college, Curtis only had 6 weeks of training on Linux, the operating system Google uses. Afterwards, he was drained but hopeful.
I thought I had a pretty good shot. 2 weeks later, I got what I call the email of death saying we can't use you right now.
After nearly 3 years of schooling and retraining, Bill Curtis's dream was over. He couldn't find another IT job. Today, he works as a corrections officer the Western Youth Institution. It's a prison in the foothills of the Blue Ridge Mountains. Recently, I spent a morning with him there.
And you're going to have pass number one?
Okay.
The work is more dangerous than Curtis's old job, cutting cloth for Broyhill sofas. I met an officer with a purple bruise over his eye. An inmate had punched him the night before.
Well, I hope that eye's feeling better.
Oh, yeah, it'll get better.
Sometimes a correction officer gets punched, or we have to get in the fray, so that's part of the job.
The inmates are mostly teenagers and include murderers. But given the economy, Curtis is grateful for the work, even if it comes in 12-hour shifts. Curtis works here 3 to 4 days a week, earning $26,000 annually. That's not enough to cover his bills. Curtis's wife, Janet, also lost her furniture job to the recession this year. So Bill works several more days a week at Walmart. He clocks in with the swipe of a plastic card. Curtis earns about $9 an hour. That's $6 an hour less than he made in furniture. Curtis works in sporting goods, but helps out wherever he can.
What can I do for you?
I need some gallons of paint.
Well, let's walk over here and I'll fix you some paint.
Thank you.
Curtis's furniture job was one of more than 6,000 that disappeared this decade from Caldwell County, about an hour's drive northwest of Charlotte. Companies sent the work to China to save money. Walmart has become a safety net for former furniture workers. Curtis is one of 30 employed here. He knows Walmart is built on the same low-cost strategy that destroyed his job, but Curtis mostly keeps that to himself.
It was just a few weeks ago, one lady, she put her hands on her hip, kind of huffed and said, "Is there nothing in this store made in America anymore?" And I said, "Well, lady, you need to call corporate office and talk to them."
Hello, Margo.
Hey.
How are you?
It's good to see you.
It's good seeing you. How are you doing?
I'm doing all right.
I first met Margo Rice around the same time I met Bill Curtis in 2007. She, too, was laid off from furniture work and was studying with Curtis in the IT program. She didn't get a job at Google either, but she's turned some of her new skills into a new career. Rice is now back at the college, setting up TV feeds for long-distance classes. Today, she's helping an instructor teach English to students in Brazil. The students are complaining about an echo.
Is there anything we can do? Because they said they couldn't fix anything on their side. So.
Tell them the best thing they can do is just to mic off until they have a question. Then that should solve the problem.
Talk into the microphone so I can see if I can hear you.
Yeah, better.
Okay.
Rice's new technology job pays about $5,000 less than her old factory one. But she likes it a lot better because it encourages her to think. Most laid-off furniture workers have not been so lucky.
What are people doing? And how are you doing compared to them, do you think?
I'm doing fantastic compared to them. Some are coming back to school to get their GED. Most of them are drawing unemployment. They just don't know. They don't know what to do.
Studies show retraining has limited effectiveness, and older workers have a much harder time finding new jobs. Derek Lingle was one of Margo Rice's classmates in the IT program, and at 23, young enough to be her son. Lingle knew a lot about Linux, the operating system Google favors. And where Rice struggled with interview questions, Lingle had answers. Earlier this year, I rode with him to his new job as a data technician at Google. He bought this silver Mitsubishi Eclipse to celebrate.
One thing I added in this car was the sunroof, because I've always wanted a car with a sunroof.
How do you like the car?
Yeah, I'm ecstatic about it.
Life at Google is nothing like a furniture factory. Many employees are in their 20s and 30s. Breaks include ping pong and blasting video game zombies on a flat-screen TV.
Swim in your guts, hell pig! Die, you capitalist dogs! Die! Die! Die!
The job is high-pressure and fast-paced. Lingle races around thousands of humming servers, fixing those that have gone down. The servers handle everything from searches of Google Maps to YouTube.
I think I repaired over 60 on one day before.
Do you ever have to run?
Yeah, I mean, we even have scooters out there on the floor to help us get from spot to spot.
Google, a highly secretive company, won't say what Lingle earns. But the benefits at Google go beyond a paycheck. The company has flown Lingle out to its Silicon Valley campus. For a guy who didn't travel much beyond Charlotte, the trip opened up a new world.
When you get out there, you see that, hey, there is this possibility. There are other opportunities. Even if you decide to leave Google at a later time, there are all these other companies out there. I mean, just being able to know that there's more, I mean, it's eye-opening.
I asked Lingle where he might like to work someday. His answers included Ireland and Belgium. In the end, Bill Curtis and Margot Rice weren't surprised Derek Lingle got the job they so wanted. Curtis says Lingle succeeded because he's young and tech-savvy.
They can do things on the computer. They'll sit there for hours, look like zombies playing video games, but they're just more technology-oriented.
And how do you compete against kids like that?
You, at my age, you can't. And, I mean, I try to do what the best I can do at what I'm familiar and educated with. But they've got the hands-on that I never had.
Bill Curtis is now 55. If he's bitter about losing out on the Google job, he won't say. Curtis says he'll keep working at the prison in Walmart 7 days a week for as long as he has to. Given the state of the job market, that could be a while.
Sometimes you get really, really tired. When you're pulling the driveway and you just turn the ignition off, you, oh, I'm home. And your feet feel like lead, but you just suck it up and come on in and go. That's the American way.
Tomorrow, the Chinese way. Chinese workers now manufacture the furniture Bill Curtis and tens of thousands of Americans once made. On Friday, we travel to China to meet them. Frank Langfitt, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. For the past 2 days, NPR's Frank Langfitt has chronicled the lives of North Carolina furniture workers who lost their jobs to China. Well, today he takes us to China to meet some of the people who got those jobs. It's a journey that spans 2 years with many twists and turns. Frank Langfitt begins in North Carolina with one of the laid-off workers.
Bill Curtis watched his job slip away piece by piece. He cut cloth for sofas at Broyhill Furniture. Over time, he noticed more cloth arriving at his factory from overseas. Then, Broyhill began slashing his hours.
Work just started to dwindle. The more we saw leave, the more containers we saw coming in, and we knew that's where our jobs went.
And where were the containers coming from?
China.
Do you have any idea what someone who does your job in China makes an hour?
I have no idea. I've seen some pictures of furniture factories over there, and it's the closest thing I could think of to slave labor from what I've seen.
Slave labor. I wondered. Curtis's furniture job was among more than 300,000 that disappeared from the United States this decade. A couple of years ago, I went looking for some of those jobs in South China. I found them in Dalingshan. Furniture factories sprawl across the city. One of the biggest is called Lacquer Craft. One evening in January 2008, I waited outside the factory's back gate. Right now it's 5:30, it's the dinner time break, and hundreds of workers are pouring out. They're wearing the same blue jackets, and they're riding bikes and walking, going to stop off and get something to eat at restaurants. Inside, they build furniture for most of the major American brands, including Broyhill, Bill Curtis's old employer in North Carolina. One of the Chinese workers I met was Zhao Sha. She prepares furniture for painting. Bill Curtis made more than $15 an hour. Zhao earns less than 70 cents an hour. But Zhao doesn't consider herself a slave. She says she's fortunate. Before working in the factory, she farmed a tiny plot of land in southwest China's Sichuan province.
We planted rice paddies, wheat, and corn. We ate what we planted. We never made any money off it.
I chatted with Zhao in the apartment she shares with her husband. They sleep on a box spring next to a DVD player and a small TV. Squalid by American standards, the conditions are a step up from Sichuan.
In a factory, you don't have to work in the sun. That's the best thing. I prefer working here. At least I get paid. At home, nobody paid me.
Zhao is among 4,000 workers at Lacquer Craft. An executive there, Hawk Cho, showed me around one afternoon in a golf cart. We came upon a stack of lumber that stood three stories high. I asked what kind of wood it was.
Baiyang.
Baiyang.
Baiyang Mu.
Baiyang Mu is a white poplar?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Baiyang Mu is the biggest.
That's the majority of our wood. It's the strongest, and it comes from around the American-Canadian border.
That's right. The company imports wood from North America, cuts it into furniture, and then ships it back across the Pacific.
There are a lot of exports to America, but some containers come back empty, so the price to ship things back in them is relatively cheap.
On my visit 2 years ago, South China was suffering from a surprise labor shortage. Instead of begging for jobs, as they once did, furniture workers could pick and choose. Workers like Chen Hong. He's 24 years old and makes $330 a month. Chen bragged he could command that wage anywhere.
If we go out looking for work, we can certainly find jobs like this and get them at the same salary. We have a lot of friends asking us if we want to work in other factories.
But all that was about to change. Back in America, housing prices were falling, so were furniture sales. Becky Song was a manager at Creation Furniture, a small company in Dalingshan. When I met her in January of 2008, Creation had already closed two factories. Song warned of worse to come.
If there is a recession in the United States, of course, Americans' purchasing power will decline and there'll be fewer orders. Factories won't be able to survive and they'll have to lay off people. Probably many factories will have to close.
Anyway, stock market murdered today.
Tracks show that U.S. foreclosure filings hit a record 1.5 million in the first half.
This is a panic, and this is fear run amok.
Becky Song's worst fears came true. The housing boom that fueled Chinese furniture factories collapsed, and Americans stopped buying. Last month, I returned to Dalingshan to gauge the damage. I'm back out in front of Creation Furniture. The place is abandoned. There's a metal security gate across the driveway. Front door of the office is strewn with an old mattress, a bunch of broken desks, and dead plants. The only person here is a security guard. I asked him what happened. He said Creation Furniture went bankrupt late last year. I also went back to Lacquer Craft, the firm that makes furniture for Broyhill and other North Carolina companies. I caught up with Hawk Cho, the executive there. He told me that in Dalingshan alone, more than 100 plants had shut down. Another factory manager said up to 400,000 workers had lost their jobs in the region and returned home to the provinces. Zhou Zhaoxin is one of the survivors. I met him one evening in the city's central square. Factory workers and locals blow off steam here, dancing each night amid the palm trees. Zhou said his factory cut hours until half its workers left.
They never say directly, "We want to fire you." They would just tell you, "You can still work here, but we have very few orders and very little work." Many people can't bear it. Then they would just quit.
Zhou is in his early 50s. He says at his age, unemployment is just a matter of time.
I'll lose my job soon. It's not possible to have a career here. You can't have a job for life. The boss can just fire you when they don't need you.
Hawk Cho of Lacquer Craft says he learned a powerful lesson from the recession. Don't depend on the American consumer. Cho is now focusing more on the Chinese market, but he says that will take time to develop.
Chinese people have a bad habit. They're comparatively frugal. They can use one piece of furniture for 10 or 20 years. Americans are much more wasteful. We prefer the way Americans consume.
In the meantime, Cho says his factories and others in Dalingshan will survive. Things are getting better. In recent months, orders from the U.S. have been picking up. And once again, Cho and his factory are looking to hire. Frank Langfitt, NPR News.
And now let's go to Back Talk, where we lift the curtain on what's happening in the Tell Me More blogosphere and get a chance to hear from you, our listeners. Lee Hill, our digital media guy, is here. Hey, Lee, what's up?
Hey, Michelle. Well, two words are driving the bulk of comments our listeners made to us this week.
Tiger Woods. Now, Michelle, you weighed in on the golfer's woes, which center on allegations that he cheated on his wife with more than a dozen women. Lots of reaction to that piece. But separately, Tell Me More producer Alicia Montgomery posted to our blog about why, as a black woman, she is thrilled that all of Tiger's alleged mistresses are white. Now, that post drew strong objections and strong support. Blogger Jill writes, Tiger probably would have seen you as a loudmouth whiner. I'm sure that he also cheated with ethnic women as well. They just haven't come out of the woodwork yet. And blogger Mim said, Tiger is married and should not be seeing any other women, black, white, brown, or whatever. Maybe if he was a closet Barbie doll collector, he could have saved himself this horrid mess.
Thank you, Mim and Jill. But for the record, Alicia is not a loudmouth or a whiner. But, and Alicia, thank you for putting yourself out there. Lee, have you been to see The Princess and the Frog?
Can't say that I have.
I didn't think so. Well, just to let you know, the new animated Disney movie is the first Disney film to feature a black princess. We talked about the historic nature of that in Tuesday's Mom's Conversation. Now, Lee, there were some people who thought we made too big of a deal about the whole black princess thing. But listener Kasten sees generational differences in how the film is being talked about.
It was wonderful that the younger children of the moms who saw the movie did not see the big deal about it. That shows me that the generation to finally put an end to racial stereotypes has been born. When I was a young, blonde-haired, blue-eyed, white girl, I would always feel so angry that I could have a Barbie that looked like me, but my non-white friends could not. I was lucky to grow up in a town where whites were the minority. It made me colorblind.
Thanks, Kasten. And Michelle, now to a quick update. On Tuesday, the District of Columbia became the latest U.S. jurisdiction to approve same-sex marriage. The bill is expected to be signed today. We talked to Michael Crawford, whose group DC for Marriage was among those advocating for same-sex marriage. In the course of that conversation, Crawford had this to say about one of the leading opponents of gay marriage in this area, Bishop Harry Jackson Jr.
Harry Jackson is not just opposed to marriage between same-sex couples. He's also opposed to health care reform, to immigration reform, because it's an opportunity to increase his national notoriety. I think it's really difficult for Harry Jackson, who campaigned against Barack Obama in 2008, to come into the district where Barack Obama won by over 90% of the vote and then claim to represent African Americans who live in the district.
Michelle, we thought it only fair to give Bishop Jackson, also a frequent guest on this program, a chance to respond, and here's what he had to say.
I was disappointed to hear Michael Crawford's characterization of me and my personal record. I did not campaign against Barack Obama. I am not anti-immigration. I'm actually pro-immigration reform. The local church I serve has 22 different nationalities. Concerning health care, I'm very concerned about the poor and access to health care. I have, however, voiced my concerns very openly about paid abortion.
As we said, we thought it only fair to give Bishop Jackson a chance to respond since Mr. Crawford's remarks were directed at him personally, and he was not present for that conversation. And, of course, the debate over the issue will likely continue, even as the district has made its own decision on this matter. But we'll leave it there for now. Thank you, Lee.
Thanks, Michelle.
And remember, with Tell Me More, the conversation never ends. To tell us more, you can call our comment line at 202-842-3522. Please remember to leave your name. You can also log on to our website. Just go to npr.org, click on Programs, then on Tell Me More, and blog it out.
You're listening to Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatto. We're talking this hour about computer data and all the data that's out there. We talked a lot about the cell phone, your cell phone that you have, but you are bombarded with, we're all bombarded with lots of data thrown at us all day long. You wake up in the morning, you turn on your radio or your TV, you flip through your paper as you drink your coffee, you listen to music on the train or in your car. You leaf through a magazine, you watch the billboards, and you overhear someone else's annoying cell phone conversation. If you add all that stuff up, all the TV shows, books, movies, text messages, podcasts, web pages, whew, that's a lot of data. But how much is it, right? We're talking science. Somebody's got to quantify it. Well, we have somebody who's been looking at it. And this was a report that comes from the University of California in San Diego called How Much Information? And my next guest is one of the authors. Roger Bone is professor of technology management at the UC San Diego, also director of the Global Information Industry Center there. He joins us from the university. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Bone.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
You're very welcome. How much data is out there? How much are we exposed to every day?
Well, we estimate that an average person on an average day is getting about 34 gigabytes of data, which is a number that's a little hard to grasp, but it's five DVDs.
It's a whole giant hard drive.
We don't store it. We couldn't possibly store it. It goes in one eye and out the other. Even more incredible to me was 100,000 words per day,
wow,
either read or heard.
Did that surprise you when you came up with those figures?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, bytes, it's hard to relate to, but 100,000 words sounds like a lot.
Mm-hmm. And do we know where most of it's coming from?
Yes, we do. Television is still the biggest single source. It's about 40% in terms of words and bytes. Oddly enough, a lot of the bytes come from computer games, which is something that has not been studied much at all. So the data there is a little bit uncertain. But the words are then distributed among a whole bunch of other sources, including a lot from radio, a certain amount from reading, and so forth.
So reading still is popular.
There is still reading, although actually what we found is that the amount of reading has increased since 1980, which was our base year. But the reason is people are now reading on the internet. They're not reading in print anymore. Mm-hmm. Or they're reading less in print and quite a lot on the internet.
And they're handwriting a lot less, I'll bet.
Well, who does that anymore at all?
Why do you need to know? Why do you need to measure all these streams of data?
Well, it's interesting to know the relative proportions from different sources, and also the growth rate was quite surprising. I was expecting it to grow at kind of a Moore's Law rate, and in fact, it's only been growing a few percent per year. So that's either a missed opportunity, or it's telling us that people don't actually care that much about getting the latest high-resolution graphics in their everyday life. They more care about the content, which is not particularly byte-intensive.
Mm-hmm. A lot of stuff gets compressed these days, the data itself.
Yes, we measured the compressed stream, which was one of the measurement decisions we had to make. So, for example, your cell phone transmits at a lower rate than your conventional phone. It's 10 kilobits per second on the cell phone and about five times that on a regular phone, which was it's interesting, and it's reflected somewhat in the quality of cell phone calls, which is not as good.
All this data that's getting thrown at us, and what did you say, 34 gigabytes or something like that, what do we do with it? Can we make any useful information out of it, or is there a difference between the data and knowledge that we take away from all this data?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, we didn't measure how much of it is assimilated. We measured how much reaches your eyeballs. Mm-hmm. Passing through into your brain, we didn't try to count that. And being retained, obviously, it's only a tiny fraction of that. People have information sources on in the background when they're driving, or they have the radio on when they're using the computer, whatever. It doesn't mean they're actually paying attention to this. And a lot of it's just entertainment in one form or another.
You've now mentioned your eyeballs twice. Does that mean our ears are not important anymore?
Well, in terms of bytes, our ears are not important. In terms of words, our ears are very important.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of byte measurements, the only thing that really adds up is moving pictures.
I see. Interesting how you've parsed that out. How do you handle multitasking? We're all into multitasking. Like if I'm watching TV and I'm surfing the internet, which is, people have their laptops on, right? One of them is serving background at any one time. How do you handle
that's
this?
Right.
Does that count as information consumption, even if I'm not paying attention to it?
Yes, the way we measured it, it's stuff you were exposed to, and you may or may not have paid attention to it. We have different data sources for different streams of data, so we couldn't really take care of the double counting. We have double counting in our data. We say an average of 12 hours per day, but it's probably more like 10 hours per day plus another 2 hours of double tasking.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that the you expected the byte consumption to be like Moore's Law, but it's actually going up very slowly.
Yes.
Why is that? I would think that it would be exponentially being bombarded with this stuff.
It's about 5%. It's only been growing at about 5% per year on a per capita basis.
Mm-hmm.
And the first reason, of course, is the number of hours in the day is fairly finite, not totally finite, but it's limited. So our consumption went up from 7 hours in 1980 to 12 hours now, which is a very slow rate of growth over spread out over 25 years. But the other big factor is that television technology has progressed very, very slowly. We looked at 2008. There's some HDTV in the 2008 data. But even HDTV in terms of byte streams is only about three times better than conventional television. So that is not going up at a Moore's Law rate. It's the old technology lock-in problem. Once you have a standard set, everything sticks to that standard and it slows down the rate of change.
But interestingly enough, you're as you said before, that your results suggest that the idea that we're obsessed with computers now is entirely true. We're still obsessed with television.
That's where a lot of the time is going, although it's there certainly are some age patterns in television consumption, as you would expect. The most television is consumed by retired people, as far as I can tell.
Is that right? You mean kids do not watch television anymore?
Well, they watch a lot less than their elders.
They time shift.
They time shift, and the average teenager watches less than 4 hours a day, whereas the average person in the 60 to 70 age bracket is watching about 7 hours per day.
And I guess advertisers watch these numbers very carefully.
Yes, and as you know, there's all kinds of efforts to figure out how to advertise on the internet.
Does your research suggest any upper limit to the amount of information that we can consume at all, that our brains are able to hold?
Well, we didn't look at the what the brain is holding. And there is a lot of interesting research where people look at fMRI scans of people and absorbing information and see what they're retaining and so forth. Certainly, there appear to be limits to that. What's happening now is we're getting more and more stuff thrown at us, probably about the same amount as sticking as before, although it's really hard to tell.
Let's go to Gordon in Honolulu. Hi, Gordon.
Greetings, gentlemen. I'd like to point out that people that are blind are really challenged by the society we live in. A lot of the data is not accessible. Even the devices for accessing data are not accessible. And it's one of the things we really have to work with and going forward into the future.
I take it from this that you are blind yourself.
Yes, I am.
And so this is a good question, and this is a good problem for people who are blind. How do we reach them? Roger, any suggestions?
Well, it's words. A lot of words are still taken in through the ears, but a lot more are taken in through reading. So that's definitely an issue. And as you know, there are assistive technologies with computer programs of various kinds. I'm not sure how well they really work, though.
Gordon, do you have a suggestion?
Well, yes, indeed. You know, the standards is the problem. The large corporate entities that control a lot of the technological innovation really do limit, you know, how rapidly we adapt. And I'd like to see a time in which we pay append to the people, places, and objects in our world the data, a tag that one could use to link to the knowledge of the world. Instead of having the genie in the bottle on your desk or in your living room, you could just encounter it, discover it in the world as you move about.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thanks for calling.
You bet.
Good suggestion. 1-800-999-8255. So where are we headed with this, Roger? Where is this all going?
Well, it's going to increase the amount of so-called multitasking goes up, as you've probably talked with other guests on this show. There's the research suggests that people aren't really understanding multiple streams of information simultaneously nearly as much as they think they are.
They're crashing with their cars a lot more.
And they're crashing, absolutely, they're crashing with their cars, and they're not paying attention to me in class, darn it.
You actually can notice the difference.
Well, to a certain extent. I mean, one of the anomalies in the information age is the face-to-face lecture still seems to be a good way of imparting information. Why on earth should that be true? Mm-hmm. And clearly there's something about our nature, our social nature, or the ability to pay attention to nonverbal cues that works better in a face-to-face situation.
Mm-hmm. So you find yourself having to put up with people who are sitting there with their laptops and not paying attention to you.
Well, I can cold call them and things like that. And But obviously, you know, they make their own decisions. I teach in graduate school and everybody's an adult. Mm-hmm. And, of course, we go to faculty meetings and some people sit around checking our iPhones.
Mm-hmm. Do you, when you collect all this data, does something like that enter in a lot? If you're driving your car and you look at the location of your car, the billboards I'm looking at, the tweets I'm doing at the same time, do you count all those as separate streams?
That is a good question. No, we're only looking at artificial data that is presented to people, not the what you see naturally. And unfortunately, I could not figure out a way to measure face-to-face conversation.
Is that right?
Yeah, I would love to do that, because if you think of face-to-face conversation as something that people used to be really good at and they would do it for hours after dinner, it's possible the amount of information we receive in bytes has actually gone down.
Interesting. We're talking with Roger Bone this hour on Science Friday from NPR News. So what does it take for you to measure that stuff?
Well, we need better models of how people assimilate information. There are estimates of the equivalent of a face-to-face conversation. As you know, probably know, Cisco has a video conferencing system. So we can put rough numbers on that. On the other hand, what I'd really like to know is how did people spend their time 100, 200, 1,000 years ago? And that, unfortunately, is before we started recording anything. Yeah. So that's going to be very hard to figure out.
Well, good luck to you, Roger. And
have a
happy holiday. Happy New Year to you.
Thanks very much.
Roger Bone is professor of technology management at the University of California, San Diego, and director of the Global Information Industry Center there.